Welcome to Not Artificially Sweetened, a weekly podcast where we reflect on all things diabetes. Your hosts are specialist physician Stan Landau and diabetes specialist nurse Michael Brown. We are passionate about using our talents to change lives for the better. Our mission is to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Nothing is off the table here as we discuss real people, their real issues and stories, and together discover real answers to many vexing practical issues in diabetes and its management.
Welcome everybody to episode 54 of Not Artificially Sweetened, and welcome Michael Brown.
Hi there, Stan.
Thanks listeners for joining us again this week. Remember, you can join us on any of our four favorite platforms, that being Spotify, Pocket Casts, the Apple Podcast app, and the Listen mobile audio app. Please continue to send in your weekly questions. Help us by filling in the poll and allowing us to feature topics that are interesting to you. Don't forget to drop us a line at podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. This episode is brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy and the CDE MyWell Reduced Calorie product range. There's been widespread awareness of omega-3 fatty acids in health and the popularity of fish oil as a source. But it's vital to recognize the importance of the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acids. Imbalance in these essential fatty acids can increase systemic inflammation, raising risks pertinent to conditions such as diabetes, well known for its inflammatory nature. Because registered dietitians have meticulously formulated MyWell products to maintain an optimal omega-3 to omega-6 ratio, selecting MyWell ensures a balanced nutritional approach to mitigating inflammation. Check out the CDE MyWell range and the CDE online pharmacy at cdeonline.co.za/MyWell. Michael, episode 54, yes. Coming up for Mother's Day this weekend, so a shout out to those moms out there and the hard work for moms, dads too. You'll get to turn further down the line. Got a great studio guest and a good week for you, Michael.
It's been a busy one. I was at the Board of Healthcare Funders Congress in Cape Town. Massive congress, I must say. Very well attended. Large concurrent trade exhibition. Really amazed at the amount of money apparently flowing around, but I wish it was translating more into the healthcare space.
It's interesting when you talk about healthcare funders together with healthcare industry, because week after week in the clinic, we see an interesting scenario. Every year, medical aids put out their formularies for medications that are available or perhaps no longer available for people with diabetes. Mm. And for those people with diabetes and healthcare providers, particularly pharmacists, you need to be mindful of the changes that occur year on year. And I'll tell you what we see quite often. We see people moving from disposable pens, pretty easy to use, to insulin cartridges, which are reasonable. They retail at a lower price and pretty good for the planet. But what a lot of people fail to recognize is that if you move brands from one year to another as a result of your medical aid having to curtail costs, you can come home with a cartridge of insulin or a penful, some of our patients like to call them bullets of insulin, that doesn't fit the pen that you were using the year before. And all of a sudden, it's 9 o'clock at night and you're getting ready to take perhaps your long-acting insulin. And you pop this glass cartridge into a pen that doesn't fit. And because manufacturers don't like to share their technology across the board, you're in dire straits now, because there's very little chance you've got of getting that insulin out of the glass vial and into your skin. It's a tricky one, Michael.
It is. It absolutely is. As you say, these things usually happen late at night when a specialist pharmacy or a pharmacy that specializes in the management of diabetes is not open and not able to assist you. And for people with type 1 diabetes, that could be a very dangerous situation. So pharmacists, medical funders, please take into account these practical considerations and how people can, being used to one type of pen for a number of years, suddenly do get confused when confronted with a new device.
Michael, maybe it's even bigger than that. People with chronic conditions such as diabetes become accustomed to their particular medications. And if the formulation of a pill changes and the color changes, then, what happened to the yellow pill?
Yes.
Where's the little red square-shaped pill?
Yes.
And it can become unsettling. And without their knowledge, there's been a substitution made with an identical ingredient at the same dose, perhaps a different brand. Mm-hmm. And even though they're still going to take it every evening before they go to bed, it's comforting to know that there's a continuity of care. Not only as we've spoken about here amongst one of our giants of diabetes medicine, all of those capital letter C's, but continuity of the pharmaceutical medications is no less important. So an important message for everybody out there to be mindful of any change that occurs in your treatment. And if it doesn't look right, don't leave the pharmacy until you are absolutely certain.
Great message there. Great reminder, Stan. Let's dive straight into our discussion with our studio guest this week. We're very pleased to have with us Andrew Helbrin. Andrew has been known to you and me, Stan, for many years. In fact, Andrew has been working diabetes longer than I have. So he started off for probably nearly the first 30 years of his practice working as the head biokineticist at the Center for Diabetes and Endocrinology in Houghton, Johannesburg. And he currently practices as a solo practitioner in private practice. Andrew is well known as a speaker on the effects of physical activity on the management of diabetes, as a supervisor of student interns in biokinetics, writing in diabetes and physical activity, and also an avid family man. He has two beautiful daughters who he loves to support in their dancing activities and so on. I don't know if they're still dancing, but he can tell us a little bit more about that now. He's also an avid sports fan and pretty physically active guy himself. I often bump into him while I'm out running. He's on his mountain bike and we often stop and have a chat. Welcome to the show, Andrew. It's a real privilege to have you with us and help guide us as to why physical activity is so beneficial. But maybe just to start, tell us a bit about yourself and the science of biokinetics. Many people may not have heard of that term before.
Good evening, Stan and Michael. Thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast. My interest in diabetes goes way back when, into probably the late 80s, when I was still doing human movement sciences, and I was looking to become a biokineticist at that stage. And it was in my honors year of human movement science that I decided to do a project on a patient with type 1 diabetes. From that sort of case study that I did, I met Dr. Larry Distiller, and I went and questioned him on the benefits of exercise in treating people with diabetes, and he gave me a whole lot of information, he gave me a whole lot of readings to read, and that really just started me on a path. Following you, I got into biokinetics, and in my honors year of biokinetics, I thought, you know, this is an interesting field to follow because exercise seems to play quite an important role in treating diabetes. So let me try and do another thesis on exercise and diabetes, and he helped me with getting clients to come and exercise at the Pretoria Biokinetic Center's sports center. And I managed to get about 15 or 16 patients together. And I did a thesis on resistance exercise and its benefit in treating type 2 diabetes. For those people who don't understand or aren't familiar with biokinetics, we're just really a branch of physiotherapy. We're the exercise branch. Physiotherapists generally are more hands-on. Biokineticists are more involved in exercise prescription and in helping people using exercise as a means of treatment. Once I'd completed that study, I was then invited to join Dr. Distiller and Dr. Cromer in their practice. They hadn't set up the Center for Diabetes yet. And I went back to my professors and I said, I've been invited to get involved in a diabetes practice. And they said, well, I think that's a great opportunity, except we don't think that you're going to get enough experience in dealing with chronic patients or with athletes. And I said, well, let me go discuss this with Dr. Distiller and Dr. Cromer. And I went back to them and they laughed. They said, the diabetes patient is the ultimate chronic patient.
Absolutely.
The diabetes patient, you're going to see a cardiac patient. You're going to see a person with peripheral vascular disease. You're going to see a person with kidney disease. You're going to see a person that may be partially blind or blind. You're going to see a person with peripheral neuropathy, a person with autonomic neuropathy. You're going to get your fair share of chronic conditions. So go back to your professor and say, don't worry, we'll sort you out. And I said, but what about athletes? I said, well, there's so many people with type 1 diabetes that are involved in high intensity sport. You're going to get your fair share of seeing athletes. You're going to see your fair share of seeing people with obesity. So I never really looked back. It was really a fascinating path that I followed. I joined Distiller and Cromer and Associates, and then that became the Center for Diabetes. And it's been a fascinating journey because people generally do very well when they start to exercise. That's really where my history comes in. I've enjoyed every minute of it, and hopefully I can help people through exercise improve their diabetes control.
This is so interesting because if I look at my own years at medical school and many doctors out there, nurses as well, predominantly perhaps not the midwives in that sense, but the training is really on sick people. Mm. What I'm hearing here in the biokinetics component is that, yep, there is this fair share of people with chronic diseases, as you've alluded to, but the athlete, the well person. That's fascinating to be training and studying on somebody who is really at the peak of their physical fitness. They are young, they're exuberant, and they've had this immense future to go with. They happen to have type 1 diabetes, and I hope we're able to explore that, because on these podcasts, we have certainly seen our fair share of ultra marathon runners and endurance people. But nice to know that Biokinetics covers both wellness and sickness in part, and that there's obviously therapeutic intervention. So Andrew, I mean, that's right at the beginning of management, the foresight of our founding fathers in essence. And you were right there. What I want to bring up, having worked with you for many years, you're also an accredited diabetes education specialist.
In the early days when I first started at the Center for Diabetes, I remember Dr. DeSilla insisting that I go on diabetes camps with kids. And I thought that was a huge learning curve for me. I found that I probably learned the most out of those because I saw it hands-on, exactly what happened with kids with diabetes that went on camps. In fact, just to go through some of the things that happened there, we used to arrive there on a Friday night with 30 kids. And you found that on that first night, everyone's blood glucose levels went up because we all enjoyed big buffet dinner. We actually didn't even have to monitor their glucose overnight because we knew that the glucose levels were running high. And the next morning they woke up high and then they started to become active. And these kids, we put them on trampolines, we swam with them, we played tennis with them, we went on hikes with them, and blood glucose levels started to come down. And over the next night, we dealt with hypoglycemic episode after hypoglycemic episode. And I thought that was a great way to learn. And that was really my initiation into education. I learned exactly how these kids responded, what we needed to do, what carbohydrate snacks we had to give them. And that was a huge learning curve for me. So I think it's an important part of any person that's interested in dealing with diabetes to actually go on these diabetes camps and really see what it's like firsthand to deal with hypoglycemia and ketones and ketoacidosis.
And you were also part of our 24-hour hotline for many years, helping people with diabetes 24 hours a day when they're presenting with all kinds of developing home treatable issues and to prevent their hospitalization.
Yeah, I remember answering the phone at 12 o'clock at night and 2 o'clock in the morning with either emergency hypoglycemia or ketones, and then trying to get hold of the doctor to wake them up to try and treat ketoacidosis. Mm-hmm. These were interesting days. It was quite stressful, I must admit, to be on call. And I can understand the stress that the current people on call have. But it was a fascinating way to learn about diabetes and how to deal with people, and especially in a crisis.
So Andrew, most biokineticists who work in a South African healthcare setting won't have your mastery of the diabetes component, nor be accredited education specialists. So if a person with diabetes or somebody involved in their care was seeking to add value to their overall management in terms of movement or physical activity, where does the biokineticist fit into the treatment planning? How has that changed in the time that you've been involved? And why are not enough people engaging with biokineticists in the world of chronic care?
That's actually a very good question. And I think it has to do with people's general attitude towards exercise, whether they see exercise as something which is difficult, blood, sweat, and tears, it's hard work, or whether they see exercise as something that's transformative, something that's going to help improve your quality of life, it's going to improve your energy levels. I think the most important thing is just to get that initial referral from a general practitioner or a physician or a diabetes team. And then I think the diabetes-trained biokineticist can kick into gear and really try and encourage those patients to become more active. But I've seen many patients over the years who have been sent by their doctors, and they come into my office and they go, I'm really not interested in exercise. And that's where my ears prick up and I go, okay, let's hear why you're not interested in exercise. What is your previous experience be with exercise? Was it a difficult experience? Was it a painful experience? Tell me about that experience. And I think for that particular case, it's not about whether we can actually prescribe exercise for that patient. It's whether we can encourage them to do a little bit of physical activity on a day-to-day basis. And we really need to decipher between what is physical activity and what is structured exercise.
Yeah.
And physical activity is any bodily movement produced by the skeletal muscles, resulting in energy expenditure above the resting state. And it's any movement, as simple as walking or gardening or cleaning the house, whereas structured exercise is more planned. So it could be going to the gym, it could be participating in a sport. And I think we've got to gauge as biokineticists where this patient is at. Are they the kind of person who likes to sit all day? Are they a person who will stand and do a little bit of housework? Are they a person we think we can get to do a bit of walking? Or could we do something a little bit more complex and give them some resistance exercises and some jogging or some cycling? We've got to gauge that person when they come in to see us. And I think that's really the skill of the biokineticist. And that's the message that I would put forward to other biokineticists, that they really need to try and get into tune with where the patient's at right from the outset.
So I'm hearing two important messages there, Andrew. One is that the power of the referring healthcare practitioner. Many people place immense value on the opinion or on the guidance of their doctor. And if doctors could realize that power to say that if I refer you to someone who can assist you getting more active, it really does make a difference. Because if my doctor says it's a good idea, then I often would agree with that. The second thing is that you pointed out that there is a continuum of acceptance of physical activity from very low levels of physical activity right the way through to formal or even competitive exercise, and that we as healthcare professionals need to be sensitive to that continuum, where that person is on that continuum, so that we can intervene in a very empathetic way that will meet that person at their point of need.
I agree 100% with that. I think the doctor's referral is very, very important. We've had a look at some of the literature out there and some of the guidelines, and most of the guidelines are actually written by doctors and by exercise specialists or biokineticists. And what we found is that in most cases, the doctors that are more likely to refer their patients to a biokineticist are the doctors that are active. So maybe as biokineticists, we need to actually encourage doctors to become more active, and then they will in turn pay it forward to their patients and encourage their patients to become more active. And in fact, it's actually quite an easy thing. The doctor just really needs to ask the patient two simple questions. What activity are you doing that gets your heart rate above resting for 10 to 15 minutes? Like, are you doing any walking? Are you doing any cycling? And the other question is, are you doing anything that will improve your muscle strength? And if the answer to that is yes, then the question is this patient safe enough to do exercise on their own? If the answer is no, then they should be probably referred to a biokineticist who can actually help them with the correct exercise prescription for their particular pathology. As far as the activity continuum is concerned, I think it's very important. Although they haven't been published yet, we looked at the current guidelines in the view of an activity continuum. So in other words, we looked at people either that are stationary or seated most of the day, and we looked to see if they go from being stationary and seated to walking or doing just a little bit of physical activity in the house, what benefit would it have on their blood glucose control, on other metabolic parameters like their cholesterol and maybe possibly the uric acid, and also how would it improve their quality of life? So as a biokineticist, we'd say, okay, at what stage are you at? Are you sitting all day? Are you walking around all day? Are you actually doing anything formal? And how can we encourage you to go from A to B and from B to C? I think in the past, we always try to sort of follow the exercise guidelines, which we know is basically 150 minutes of endurance type activities like walking or cycling a week. And it's 2 to 3 times a week resistance exercise. Mm-hmm. And we used to go, okay, every person that comes into my office, we must try and encourage to follow the guidelines and they should follow that approach. But in actual fact, if we can just get that person to get up out of their chair, walk around the house every half hour, or walk up and down the stairs, or go and walk around the garden, we'll be doing just as much for them for their blood glucose control as somebody doing a formal exercise routine. So I think we just need to change our approach.
I'm going to ask you a question that's often asked of me, and I'm going to hear each of your answers, and they may be identical. This is the most common question I get around physical activity and why a lot of people, particularly those with type 2 diabetes, don't like participating in exercise. It goes like this. Doc, I went for a walk, I went for a run, and my blood sugar went up. And I was horrified. I always understood that if I did what I was asked to do, my blood sugar levels will come down. And Doc, I hadn't eaten breakfast, went for a walk in the early morning, not as the winter months as it is now, came home and the sugar was higher than when I started. Andrew, Michael, you'll get a turn on this as well. Why would blood sugar go up at the start of physical exercise? Is it a problem? Do we need to do anything about it?
Yeah, basically, we don't really have to worry about that because what happens during exercise is not as important as what happens over the next 24 hours. So we know that if a person's exercising first thing in the morning, there's your waking hormones, which may cause the blood glucose levels to go up slightly. There's a little bit of excitement. You're going for a walk. You might be walking up a hill. So you might produce some adrenaline, which may push the blood glucose levels up. But it's only a temporary effect. Remember, the benefit of exercise actually occurs over the next 24 hours. So when you go for a walk, you're using up glucose as an energy source, and you're also using up stored glucose, which is glycogen. And for a period of 24 to 48 hours post-exercise, your muscles and liver act like sponges, and they draw glucose out of the blood, hence lowering the blood glucose levels. And this occurs for 24 to 48 hours post-exercise. So the benefit that you'll see from your morning exercise, you'll probably see at lunchtime, or you'll see just before supper or just before bed or the following day. So I wouldn't be too concerned with just a once-off exercise session that shows a slight increase in blood glucose.
Yeah, I think just to add from my side as a specialist nurse, the one time I would be a little bit concerned is someone with type 1 diabetes. The general recommendation is that if your blood glucose is over 14 millimoles per liter, that you're probably a little bit deficient on insulin. Until you can get it below that level, we wouldn't advise any physical activity. But certainly, as you said, from then on, walking and other types of exercise generally will drop blood glucose over the next 24 to 48 hours. I've seen it rise in two main instances. One where you're a little bit too exuberant about your exercise, and maybe you're exercising above your current level of fitness, and as you said, releasing hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. And the other time is when you're indulging in high intensity or resistance exercise. And Andrew, you can tell us a little bit more about that. We can use that in conjunction with low intensity endurance or aerobic exercise, which normally makes blood glucose fall, but act as a sort of counterbalance to prevent the exercise-induced hypoglycemia. Am I talking rubbish or am I on the right track, Andrew?
You are definitely on the right track. I think what we need to first go through is what happens when you do endurance type activities and what happens when you do resistance type activities. So endurance type activities, or examples of endurance type activities, are walking or running or jogging. It's any exercise that's performed at a low intensity for a longer period of time. And with this type of activity, you generally see a blood glucose drop. So if a person says to me, which types of exercises generally cause hypoglycemia, blood glucose levels to go down, I would say that walking in most cases.
Very powerful.
So ask people when their last major hypo was walking around the hypermarket.
Christmas shopping.
Yeah. And thank goodness there were sweets and chocolates available to treat the hypo. And if you ask them generally what environment you were in when you had your hypo, well, I was relaxed. I was walking along the beach. It was hot and I had a massive hypo. Resistance exercises are shorter in nature. You'll exercise one body part, then you'll have a rest, then you'll exercise another body part, have a rest. It's normally higher in intensity. And with this higher intensity, you do tend to get a bit of an adrenal response. And the way that we use it in practice is that if a person has a tendency to go low, if they, let's say, jump on the treadmill when they go to the gym or jump on the bicycle, then what we do is we rather start with the resistance type activities so that we produce a bit of adrenaline, and this will actually prevent the person from going low. If they have a tendency to go high with exercise, then we'd rather start with the endurance type activities. So that just seems to be an approach that people can use. A lot of the time it is trial and error with how you're going to respond. And a lot of the time it depends on how much insulin is circulating. So even if you do a high intensity exercise and your blood sugar levels are sitting on 5, your blood glucose levels may drop further. So we've always got to be wary of the amount of circulating insulin, what we've eaten just beforehand, if we're stressed, if we're not stressed. So there's a number of factors that actually play a role in type 1 diabetes. Another factor is if we're exercising in a warm environment or a cold environment. So if you're going to exercise in a warm environment, you tend to get vasodilatation, better circulation of insulin, better absorption of insulin, better absorption of glucose. So you tend to have more hypoglycemic episodes. If you're in a colder environment, you get more vasoconstriction, poorer circulation of the insulin, and we tend to get more hypoglycemia. But I've seen a girl with type 1 diabetes in a cold sea in George, having a massive hypoglycemic reaction, being pulled out by the lifeguards. In fact, my kids came running up to me and they said, the lifeguards have just pulled the kid out of the water and they're going to start CPR. And I said, well, I know CPR, but the lifeguards should know how to do CPR. And they said, no, they're trying to put Coke in her mouth. I went and helped her, and when we managed to get her around, we managed to put a bit of coke just in the buccal cavity, and we managed to bring the blood glucose levels up. And I sat with her for about 45 minutes, and we just discussed what had happened. And what had actually happened in her case was that she'd run out of strips, and she hadn't measured her blood glucose levels before she went into the water. Mm-hmm. So she probably was sitting on about 5, went into the water, and thank goodness her mother was with her and recognized the hypoglycemic episode, because it could have been disastrous. But that was freezing cold water, and she just had enough insulin on board, and blood glucose levels dropped, and she went into a hypoglycemic coma. But hopefully, we can all learn from these experiences, and people will always check their blood glucose levels before they go into the water or before they do anything that's activity-based. And we've got fantastic equipment these days with CGMs and monitoring systems that we can really make good decisions about how much to decrease your insulin or how much carbohydrate you need to take to prevent hypoglycemia.
I think the practicalities are exactly that. My sugar's going up. Do I run first or do I do weights? Do I do it the other way around? When do I eat? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's good philosophy to have good care, yeah. But it's one thing when we actually solve a problem. Mm. Why is the sugar going up? Yeah, there you answered the question. People now know why the sugar goes up. Okay. That's key to Absolutely. Me. So, you know, you've always been at the coalface of the clinical component. You know, and I say to you, I never knew that. I literally never knew that. There we go. Nice. No, we're much better at managing blood glucose from a carb counting point of view and insulin dose matching than we are from an exercise point of view. And all of the supreme athletes who've come into the show have said exactly what you've said, trial and error. There wasn't a single medical practitioner or somebody in the team who could give them any sense of what it would take to run 100 miles or to cycle 100 kilometers. They had to know their body, they had to know their glucose trends, what they eat, what they like to eat, as opposed to a cookbook approach. And it's interesting when you look at guidelines that come out from time to time, you know, if sugar under 5, do this. And somebody will say, well, you know, we did that and we had the exact opposite effect. So teaching is good, but the lived experience is even better. And it's the trial and error that it's not going to show that. Where I struggle are the school kids. Because the sports change from season on season and sports stop and start. So it's one thing, hockey and rugby and netball, for example, you're playing and then you're stopping and then you're playing and you're stopping. And then tennis is an endurance component. And then it's gymnastics in the afternoon sometimes. Mm. And these kids do everything. It can be very difficult to kind of piece together that. But if you break them up into individual segments and work through each one, it makes it a lot easier than looking for a blanket approach. I'm not sure if that's the correct way of doing it, Andrew.
Yeah, teenagers, kids are very tricky because they tend to do more spontaneous type activities without taking the right precautions. So, for example, a kid after supper may go and ride on their bicycle outside in the yard for an hour, and they'll come inside, have a shower and go straight to bed without taking a snack before they go to bed. And then, you know, you wake up with a disaster at 2 o'clock in the morning and the parents are trying to treat a kid that's in a hypoglycemic coma. And that's when it becomes quite stressful. And if we just look at it carefully and recognize that this kid is actually doing physical activity for an hour on their bike and that they need to take a protein snack before they go to bed just to cover them for the night, or they need to decrease their long-acting insulin, we can live and learn. And I think that's really the bottom line. If we approach an athlete, most of the time I learn from what happens during training or what happens during qualifying events. So we've had one or two patients doing the Ironman, and it's very important that we monitor them during their practice events to see pretty much how they're going to respond during the swim. Mm. Are the blood glucose levels going to go up? Are they quite excited first thing in the morning? The water's quite cold. They've just eaten. They've just taken their insulin. What happens during the cycling event? Is this their strong event? Will the blood glucose levels go down? Are we going to deal with hypoglycemia here? How much carbohydrates do we need to take in? How many calories do we need to take in just to make sure that the blood glucose levels remain stable during the race? Because if you start to have a hypoglycemic event during the race, it's probably the end of your race.
You're done.
So it's going to be quite difficult to treat it.
Yeah.
A lot of it is trial and error and just learning from those practice events. And that will build confidence for that person participating in those types of events. And you'll be amazed at what people can actually achieve. I always say to my clients with type 1 diabetes that you need to exercise as often as you can, because then you'll learn how your body responds. If you're going to exercise today and then 2 weeks later, you're going to have a bad response. Mm-hmm. You'll have a hypo and you won't want to do it every day. But if you do it every day, you're going to learn.
Absolutely. Andrew, the effects, the beneficial effects of endurance activities like running or walking, jogging, swimming, and so on are well known. We know that there are beneficial effects on blood glucose management, on body composition, depression, cardiovascular health, many, many benefits. But I noticed with interest that you said you did your biokinetic thesis on the effects of resistance exercise in the management of diabetes. You were way ahead of your time and your thinking. Share a little bit about how important resistance exercise is generally for all people, specifically for the management of diabetes. And that's why we're seeing it coming more and more into the guidelines. And then I'd love you just to say a few words about something that really irritates me that's not ubiquitous in the guidelines, proprioception, balance, and fall prevention.
We know, as I mentioned, there's two types of activities. There's endurance, you're walking and you're running, and then there's resistance type activities. And the importance of resistance activity is really to prevent sarcopenia, a diminishing muscle mass. And we know that as you age, you develop sarcopenia. And sarcopenia has a negative effect on diabetes. It has a negative effect on certain cancers as well. So people tend to develop sarcopenia because of certain cancers and also related to their cancer treatments. Mm-hmm. The important thing is to try and build body mass or build muscle mass or build lean tissue, which will help improve basal metabolic rate, which may aid in weight loss. It may aid in stabilizing the person from a balance point of view. It may help prevent falls. So it plays a very important role from that perspective. I chose a resistance training at that time because it was easier to actually measure. We could actually put each person on various pieces of equipment and actually measure how much they were improving by, and we could monitor their blood glucose levels before and after. I was also involved in another study at the time, which was actually testing the safety of dimicron with cycling. So I decided I would do a resistance training program with the patients for my thesis. But what was interesting is that in a study done in 2006 by Segal, he looked at which exercises were actually more beneficial, whether endurance exercises were more beneficial as opposed to resistance exercise, and then looked at the combination of exercises. And they compared about 250 people with type 2 diabetes, of which the endurance type activities actually improved quite significantly. In fact, they improved by about 0.6%, the HbA1cs, over a six-month period. And that was really just doing 45 minutes of cycling three times a week. The resistance training group, this is in 2000, improved only slightly. It only improved by about 0.2%, which wasn't really significant. But when you combined endurance and resistance, you improved by 1.3%, which was highly significant. Yeah. It was almost as if you were going onto an extra drug.
Absolutely.
And I always questioned that. I said, well, you know, why didn't that resistance training group do that well? And the answer that came from him was, we probably didn't push them hard enough. So I think what we need to do with resistance type exercises going forward, and this is in the latest guidelines, is that as you get a little stronger, so you need to start increasing that resistance. We need to start increasing the resistance, and that will in turn improve the HbA1c to a point where it's more clinically significant. But if you combine exercises, you tend to get actually the best response. And that was really the message that came out of Segal's study, that people need to combine exercises. Why do you need to combine exercises? Because people get a bit complacent when you're just doing one type of exercise. So people get a little bit bored of just walking every day or just cycling every day, or they might get bored of just doing a gym circuit. But if you combine it and you do walking one day, a gym circuit the next day, maybe a bit of Tai Chi and yoga the following day, you tend to get your best response when you have a bit more variety in the type of exercise that you prescribe. The question about peripheral neuropathy and balance and preventing falling. First thing I look at when a patient walks into my office is how they walk. You know, are they walking like Frankenstein or are they walking normally? And that is the key, because I think if we can work on proprioception and balance and just train balance, that patient will do a lot better, you know, improving their core, improving their ability to stand on one leg and so on. They'll do a lot better as far as their peripheral neuropathy is concerned.
We're hearing there that movement, good sleep, good mental health, medication, nutrition continue to remain those cornerstones of treatment. And it's probably been under-recognized because you have an idea that you're either doing 150 minutes a week at massive vigor and no session can be less than 45 minutes and no 2 days between activities, as the guidelines were historically. And as we saw, Michael, when you and I spoke through the American Diabetes Guidelines, that paradigm is being changed now. And the concept of movement and movement for enjoyment or for pleasure becoming perhaps more relevant in the lives of people who have many medical conditions or what we refer to as multimorbidity. Mm-hmm. But you're going to need an exercise expert. And we're blessed in South Africa because you often hear people, particularly guys who came to train with Andrew and the interns he had, it doesn't exist overseas. It's a luxury. And here we have great universities putting out high-class clinically orientated people, which we're blessed in this country, because at the end of the day, Andrew, your training may be one thing, but you are on the ground. And I think very modestly, Michael may have omitted to mention that you personally got a boxing license together with Dr. Debbie Gordon back in the day and trained Flo Simba. He was a South African world heavyweight champion boxer, a person with type 1 diabetes, phenomenal. Even before Jonathan Collins got his wings in that sense. So, you know, it's wonderful that a lot of that pioneering stuff having come out of Africa. And we're really glad that you were able to join us on the show, because for listeners out there and people involved in diabetes management, people with diabetes and their carers, particularly the carers at this point in time for sarcopenia, training, proprioception, balance, avoiding falls. I don't always think of that in the context of diabetes. We're so focused on the numbers, but a fall is catastrophic, particularly if you can't feel your feet.
For sure.
Michael, it's been a non-stop show. We've really gotten some great questions answered, and I hope our listeners, if you have thoughts, don't forget to share with us on podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. Perhaps you have had a favorite experience with exercise, or perhaps you want to share with us why exercise isn't something that you particularly enjoy.
Thank you, Stan. And thank you very much, Andrew, for joining us.
Thank you.
I think there's a lot more still to cover, but we'll be getting you back at some time if you would give us that honor, and we'd love to have you back. Listeners, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to take you out with our advocacy message this week, this time from diabetes advocate Lynn Sewell.
With so many requests received from you for advice on living with painful diabetic neuropathy, we ask you to listen to the weekly podcast of Not Artificially Sweetened, episode 41, where Nina Johnson explains BSR. This is body stress release. We also ask you to listen to episode 50, where Dr. Stan Landau and Michael Brown give us valuable information on diabetes neuropathy. As Michael says in episode 50, the best way to treat diabetes-related neuropathy is not to get it. Both these episodes will definitely be able to guide you and help you in some form in living with painful diabetic neuropathy.
Great message there from Lynn. And listeners, we'll be with you again next week. Andrew, it's been great having you with us.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. Be well and stay fit.
Like Andrew always says, if you're not taking your exercise pill, you're probably omitting your most important treatment.
Yeah, I like that. Stay fit, stay well.
Just a reminder that this episode was brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy and the new range of CDE MyWell reduced calorie products. There are many ways to reduce inflammation. One of the biggest factors is the foods that we eat. With MyWell, carefully crafted by dietitians to bring you the perfect balance of nutrients, you can be sure that you are getting the right balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. Registered dietitians, please consider the CDE Academy Very Low Calorie Diet course for health professionals. Details, as usual, are in the show notes for this episode. And with that, folks, it's over and out from us. Thank you for joining us on Not Artificially Sweetened, where we aim to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Anything we discuss is for your reflection, education, personal growth, and entertainment only. You join this podcast at your own risk, and we are not responsible for any omissions, errors, or unwanted medical outcomes. Please note the following important, specific disclaimers. For people with diabetes, the health professionals on this podcast are not your personal caregivers. Always discuss any new information with your diabetes team before acting on any aspect of it. The views and opinions discussed are those of the hosts only and do not represent those of any other entity. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you encounter in this session. Anything you learn or experience here cannot substitute for personalized, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For health professionals working in diabetes, always discuss any new information with your clinical team before acting on any aspect of it. You are personally accountable and liable for any choices made in a clinical setting according to your level of training and legal scope of practice. Any information or insights gained here must be used with your professional discretion and with the developing base of clinical evidence, local and organizational laws, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. Good luck with your diabetes care missions. Till next time.